Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Steve Romanin, co-hosting, doing some wizardry with the producing today. Thanks so much for setting up the show. I'm really excited about it. Before we jump into the show, we're going to hear some news from Steve, but I'll give you a little bit of an introduction to what we're going to be talking about today. This is a show that I've wanted to do for about a year and a half, and it is on palm oil in particular. We're going to be talking about Sumatran orangutans, and specifically we're going to be connecting with Helen Buckland, who is the UK director of the Sumatran Orangutan Society, and we'll be talking to her at about quarter after. We're going to learn about biofuels, oil palm production, some of the impacts on communities within Indonesia in particular. And of course, we're going to be talking about the orangutans themselves and the various different ways that their numbers are being pretty severely threatened at this point. And I think, as Steve had mentioned in the little blurb about the show, which is on our website, animalvoices.ca, this is really an issue that has a lot of different intersecting axes. We'll be talking about globalization, environmental degradation, colonization, and of course, another shun, animal exploitation. So it's something that affects a lot of vegan communities as well. There's a lot of debate about this issue because palm oil is in so many different things, including a lot of vegan goodies. And so is palm oil even vegan? Should it be considered vegan is, of course, a question that a lot of people are asking. So I think it'll be a really interesting show for people who are near a computer right now. If you want to check out the fantastic website for SOS, the Sumatran Orangutan Society, please do check it out. There's tons of information. We'll go through a lot of it today with the UK director, Helen Buckland. But before we do that, we're going to hear from Steve.
Yeah, some more positive news, actually. The first article is coming to us from the New York Times, and it reads, "Tasty vegan food? Cupcakes show it can be done. Many people equate a vegan diet with deprivation, thinking that recipes prepared without eggs, butter, meat, or other animal products are certain to be tasteless and boring. But the reputation of vegan cooking got a much-needed public relations lift this summer from an unlikely place, the Food Network's popular new show, Cupcake Wars. The program, which each week features four of the country's top bakers facing off in three elimination challenges, recently pitted a 22-year-old vegan chef, Chloe Coscarelli, against three bakers of traditional high-end cupcakes. The judges were skeptical at first. Quote, "I was surprised at the bravery and boldness to parade four different flavors of vegan cupcakes in front of the judges when everyone else was clearly going to be working with butter and eggs," said one judge, Candace Nelson, the owner of Sprinkles Cupcakes in Beverly Hills, California. "I thought it was possibly working at a disadvantage." Mrs. Coscarelli not only survived the first round, but did so to rave reviews. In the second round, her cupcakes, Chocolate Strawberry Shortcake, Raspberry Tiramisu, and Cream-Filled Orange and Chocolate, captivated the judges. And then she took the final round, a presentation involving 1,000 cupcakes. The victory won her a $10,000 prize and the chance to supply the cupcakes for OK Magazine celebrity event. Quote, "Of all the shows we've done, the thing I hear the most is, were those vegan cupcakes really that good?" Miss Nelson said. "People are in sort of disbelief that this vegan chef beat out the rest of the competition. My answer is yes, they were delicious. It was everything we were looking for in a cupcake." Vegan eating has had a growth spurt in recent years. The book Skinny Bitch by Rory Friedman and Kim Barnunen have the sassy arguments for vegan eating has been a bestseller for years. The China Study by T. Colin Campbell and Thomas M. Campbell II, which takes a scientific look at the benefits of plant-based eating, has sold more than 500,000 copies. And celebrities like Ellen DeGeneres and the Glee star Lea Michele have embraced vegan eating. But what was different about Miss Coscarelli's Food Network triumph was that it didn't rely on health or dietary benefits or sympathy for animals to provide the virtues of vegan food. Instead, the vegan cupcakes just tasted better. "I think the waves it created and the coverage it got showing that vegan food can stand up to traditional baking is enormous," said Colleen Howard, the co-founder and associate publisher of Veg News magazine, to which Mrs. Coscarelli is a contributor. Quote, "It was a pretty big moment for getting vegan food out there and showing that there's no deprivation and that it's the same level of food that's made with eggs, butter, and milk." Ms. Coscarelli of Los Angeles, a recent graduate of University of California, Berkeley, and the Natural Gourmet Institute in New York City, said she tried out for the show hoping to change the image of vegan baking. Still, she worried that the network and the judges might reject the notion of vegan cupcakes out of hand. Quote, "It was a huge risk," she said. "I think right now veganism is portrayed as that horrible stereotype of hippie food that really doesn't taste good and that's bland. I wanted to break through with a different image that vegan food can taste exciting." Since the episode was shown in June and repeated in August, Ms. Coscarelli said She has been swamped with emails and inquiries to her website, chefchloe.com. She's heard from several parents of children with egg or dairy allergies who are excited by the opportunity to finally bake cupcakes for their children. People are really inspired, she said. They realize it's not weird if they're choosing to eat well or different way or to eliminate certain ingredients. This shows it can still be done well. The biggest challenge of vegan baking is to create moist, light, and rich-tasting cake without eggs and butter, their traditional binding ingredients for pastry dough. Quote, I use a combination of baking soda and vinegar. It may sound gross, but it works chemically to bind the cupcakes, Ms. Coscarelli said. If the flavor is there, it doesn't matter what kinds of ingredients you're using to hold it all together. For frosting, traditional bakers use butter or shortening, whipping it with powdered sugar and other ingredients. Ms. Coscarelli substitutes organic refined coconut oil and non-hydrogenated margarines to achieve the same creamy texture. Other winning ingredients like fresh raspberries and pure dark chocolate are vegan to begin with. On her videos and in her recipes, Ms. Coscarelli is venturing beyond cupcakes. Recently on her blog, she offered black bean sliders with spicy mango sauce and guacamole, accompanied by Cajun yam fries. In January, her mango masala panini, made with spiced chickpeas, roasted cauliflower curry, and mango chutney, won a sandwich competition in Brentwood, California, beating out panini made with animal products like spiced pork loin, ham, and Gruyere cheese. She says her goal is not to convert people to veganism, but instead to promote balanced eating and delicious recipes made from fresh, whole ingredients that just happen to be vegan. I like the challenges of cooking vegan because there's more ways to impress people by showing them that it's delicious, and it's vegan, and it's healthy, she said. I also like that if you're making cookie dough and there are no eggs in it, you can eat the batter. That's one of the benefits of vegan baking. You can always lick the spoon.
Which you were saying before we went on air, that you loved that about vegan baking when you first started.
It was surprising when I first started. That's not to say I didn't eat it before,
yeah.
But just that now I won't get sick. And our second article is coming to us from Mail Online. The title, Clone Farms Milk is on Sale. Food Watchdog Investigates After Dairy Farmers' Astonishing Admission. Milk from the offspring of cloned cows is secretly and illegally going into high street shops. Despite deep unease among consumers, the milk is not being labeled or identified in any way, leaving shoppers in the dark about what they are drinking. The dairy farmer involved said he wanted to remain anonymous because the British public regards cloning as so distasteful that buyers would stop taking his milk. Last night, the Food Standards Agency said it would investigate. It told the Mail that it believes the sale of milk from such cows is illegal under food regulations. Research has identified serious concerns for the health and well-being of animals produced as a result of cloning. There is evidence of premature births, deformities, and early death. The cows being used to produce the controversial milk start life in the U.S. as embryos created from the eggs of cloned, prize-winning Holstein cows and the sperm of normal bulls. The embryos are frozen and flown to the U.K. where they are implanted into host cows. The resulting supersized animals can be used to produce massive quantities of milk and for breeding purposes. The Mail blew the whistle on this trade in clone farm cows more than 3 years ago following the birth of Dundee Paradise on a farm in Shropshire. Subsequently, we revealed that a total of 8 such calves were born on British farms. It now appears that the milk from at least one of these animals, and possibly many more, is being sold for human consumption. The Mail revelations in 2007 were a complete surprise to the government's Food and Farming Department, DEFRA, and the FSA, which had no knowledge of the births. Subsequently, the EU and European Food Safety Authority, EFSA, launched a major investigation in order to decide on how to handle the controversial technology. As a result, earlier this month, Euro MPs voted in favor of a ban on meat and milk products from clones and their offspring going into human food without approval. However, the regime has not been passed into law. Details of the claim that clone farm milk is reaching the public appeared in the respected International Herald Tribune. It said that a British dairy farmer had admitted using milk from a cow bred as a clone as part of his daily production. The man said he was also selling embryos from the same cow to breeders in Canada. He said that part of the reason he was staying anonymous was that he did not want to be required to get rid of a valuable cow. An FSA spokesperson said, quote, since 2007, the FSA interpretation of the law has been that meat products from clones and their offspring are considered novel foods and would therefore need to be authorized before being placed on the market. As the UK authority responsible for accepting novel food applications, the agency has not received any applications relating to cloning, and no authorizations have been made. The agency will, of course, investigate any reports of unauthorized novel foods entering the food chain, end quote. European experts have not identified a food safety risk associated with cloning, but some campaigners claim it would allow new diseases to pass from farm animals to humans. The RSPCA and Compassion in World Farming are among a number of groups opposed to farm animal cloning for food. The chief policy advisor to Compassion in World Farming, Peter Stevenson, said, I would be appalled if milk from a cloned offspring cow is coming into the food chain in the UK. As a farmer has acknowledged, the public is deeply concerned about this food and does not want it. If this is happening, it demonstrates that there are very serious loopholes in the way food production is policed in this country. The government has known that these animals were in the country for at least 3 years, but it appears to have done nothing to ensure any milk or meat is not reaching the public. End quote. A study conducted by the FSA found widespread opposition to clone farming and food. Dr. Steve Griggs, who led the research, said, quote, "The majority of people came to the conclusion that they would not want to eat such food. The overwhelming majority did not want it or were unsure. They struggled to identify any convincing benefits for them as consumers. There were concerns about the ethical side of animal cloning. Indeed, whether we have the moral right to go down this road." And that's the news today.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Steve Romanin just brought us the news. I'm always curious about your choices. So why did you choose those ones in particular for this week?
Well, the cupcake article, I think, harkens back to the interview we did with Kelly Childs from Kind Foods and the recent food fair that just passed in Toronto this past weekend. So food was on my mind, as it typically is anyway. And the other article, really, I was just perusing the AR news feed, found this article, and it really struck my interest as something that sort of encapsulates a lot of different animal issues into one event, really. You know, some milk is getting in the food chain and this is causing such an uproar, but there's all kinds of other issues in this article.
Right. All sorts of gaps. Who's left out?
Yeah.
Right. Animals themselves.
That's right. Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and talk with the UK director of the Sumatran Orangutan Society. We'll talk about palm oil production in particular. And there's so many different issues, really, that are affecting the few remaining orangutans in Sumatra and Borneo. We're going to be talking about Sumatra today, and it's a really fascinating issue. I was learning about it more this week as I was doing research, and I felt my ignorance pretty much being repeatedly shattered, and there's so much to learn. It's such a huge issue. There's been murmurs about this for a while. Greenpeace has done a big campaign trying to raise awareness about palm oil. And I really hope that people stay tuned. I think it'll be a fascinating show. And we have one of the key players in the advocacy movement, Helen Buckland, that will be on the program today. I want to say a big thank you, too, before we go to music, to Charissa for coming in once again. We love you. Thank you so much for teching for us. And I should direct people to our website, animalvoices.ca. You can check out this program in about a week or so. We also have 300-plus shows that are archived that you can access for free by going, again, to animalvoices.ca. Steve has been really on top of the Facebook group lately, too, so if you want to join us there, that would be great. Become a friend of the program, and you can always write us. We'd love to hear from you if you have ideas for upcoming shows or any feedback about the programs. You can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. We're going to come back with Helen. Please stay tuned. Hello, and welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. On today's show on Animal Voices, we're speaking with one of the key members of the Sumatran Orangutan Society. We're speaking with the UK director, Helen Buckland. I'm so thrilled that she's here. I've really wanted to talk about issues affecting orangutans for a long time now, and I'm just delighted that Helen can be here with us today. She has a master's degree in primate conservation, certainly has done lots of amazing work, and I wanted to warmly welcome you, Helen, to the program.
Thanks very much.
So we're reaching you, I guess, later afternoon, where you're at?
That's right, yeah.
And you've been involved with the Sumatran Orangutan Society for a few years now. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and what brought you to this organization?
Yeah, absolutely. My first degree was actually in psychology and biology, and I became interested in conservation through learning about some chimpanzees at Central Washington University that have been taught to communicate using American Sign Language. So I came to this really through an interest in primate cognition and intelligence, and then sort of fell into being more interested in the conservation of these animals in the wild. So I went on to do a master's degree in primate conservation, as you mentioned, at Oxford Brookes University here in the UK. And at that point, I went on my first trip to Borneo and saw my first wild orangutan, saw miles and miles of oil palm plantations where there used to be forests, and the rest is history, really. I've been with SOS for almost 5 years now since then.
What was that like, your first experience in Borneo then, when you're standing there in the midst of this plantation and looking out the devastation?
Well, it's a very mixed experience, the whole trip, really. I mean, I flew into Jakarta and then took a small plane over from Jakarta onto the island of Borneo, and looking out of the windows was the first time I'd been to a tropical country or anywhere outside Europe or North America. I saw a lot of greenery out of the window, but then when you look a bit closer, all the trees were in uniform lines, you know, lined up in a monoculture plantation. That was quite shocking. But of course, on the same trip, I had the opportunity to visit Tanjung Puting National Park, which is a very famous national park where orangutan research has been going on for many, many years. And I was able to visit another area forest called Sabangau, which has since been made into a national park. It wasn't at the time. So there was, you know, some good news and good experiences happening there as well. Being able to see a wild orangutan is obviously quite a thrilling experience and very motivating for the work that we do. But to see the oil palm plantations, obviously I'd only read about them and seen photos at that stage, but to be able to stand in one and hear the silence, basically the deafening silence, compared to being in the forests where it's noisy, but, you know, nature all around you, and then standing in a plantation, it's absolute silence. It's not even birds calling or, you know, any sign of wildlife there at all. Mm.
There's so many issues that are affecting the great apes, and I'm wondering why you chose to put so much of your effort recently on issues in particular in Sumatra and with the orangutans there. Why this issue for you? Why is it important to you?
Well, I mean, the great apes represent so much more than just themselves as a species. They're, you know, they're charismatic animals and they're close to us genetically, but my opinion is that even if they weren't close to us genetically, there's plenty of room on this planet for humans and great apes to live together. And all the great apes really represent the habitats that they live in as well, which are vitally important to humans all around the world, not just in the countries where these forests are standing. I think in terms of orangutans, they grab my attention just because, well, the Sumatran orangutan in particular, because it is deemed to be the great ape species most likely to go extinct in the wild first before any others, even though there's far fewer mountain gorillas left on this planet than Sumatran orangutans, but each one of them is known and named and followed and protected much better than the Sumatran orangutans currently are. So I think it was the fact that they are really quite so close to the edge and need quite so much help that really inspired me to get involved with this charity.
I hate to sound like an alarmist, but as I was reading through the materials, I did feel a sense of panic. It really seems like it's a crisis.
It absolutely is, yes. I mean, we like to try and remain optimistic and tell people about all the great work that's being done and all the opportunities there are for conservation and positive stories, and there are a lot of those out there, but yes, you can't get away from the fact that it's a very urgent situation. There's various different predictions about how long Sumatran orangutans have left, you know, anything from between 10 to 50 years, but certainly within a generation it's possible that they will disappear. But at the same time, there's a lot of great stuff being done to protect them and a lot of commitments being made by the Indonesian government, which we hope they'll uphold, to keep protecting the habitat. And, you know, that's really the key to protecting the species.
Right, it really has to depend on the context. It's really not enough just to say we need to save the animals, and that's something I've appreciated about the site as well. Can you give us a snapshot of who orangutans are? How would you introduce the species in Sumatra to our listeners about, you know, a day in the life of a forest orangutan? I guess they're all in forest. The word orangutan means forest person?
Yes, it means man of the forest in the Malay language, that's right.
And they build nests? I mean, so many things were mind-blowing. Like, we think about birds and nests, but these are animals that also, they live in the forest canopy and they make nests.
Yes, that's right. Well, they're quite different from the other great apes. Obviously, their colour, the fact they're the only great apes found outside Africa, but they're much less sociable, actually, than gorillas and chimpanzees. They don't live in large family groups. The largest group you'll see really is a mother with her offspring. The infants live with their mothers until they're about 8 years old. So it's a really long time to stay with their mothers before heading off into the wild to make a life for themselves. They spend a lot of time travelling around the forest foraging, looking for fruit trees. They have excellent mental mapping facilities, or skills, I should say, so they can remember which trees will be fruiting at which particular period, you know, which can sometimes be just once every few years. They can remember where the fruiting trees are in the forest and travel around to find enough food to survive. As you said, they build nests, a new nest each night. A friend of mine actually is doing a PhD at the moment on exactly that topic, learning about how the orangutans make their nests. It's quite fascinating. They actually, there's certain leaves that have anti-mosquito properties, and they pick these leaves and scatter them around their nests to keep insects away from them while they're sleeping at night. They're very, very intelligent creatures.
Steve and I are just sitting here kind of shaking our heads because they just sound like amazing animals. So what else do you feel is relevant to talk about in terms of how they move through the world, what their lives are like? And then I wanted you to talk about how their lives have now been affected by the encroachment of various different industries, in particular the oil palm production.
Yes, orangutans can survive in forests that have been selectively logged or disturbed in some way by humans. They live at lower densities, so that means the orangutans need a larger overall area to be able to find enough food to survive. But when it comes to the forest being completely clear-cut and replaced by monoculture plantations such as oil palms and other commodities for human consumption, then that's when the orangutans really get into trouble, because they're a completely arboreal animal, which means they spend all of their lives in the trees. Only orangutans which have been kept in captivity by humans and then released back into the forest would ever really come down to the ground. Wild orangutans stay in the trees all the time, but they can't survive in oil palm plantations. That's not a food source for them. It's not their habitat that they need to survive. So when, as I say, when the forest is completely clear-cut and turned into plantations, then the area of forest available to them to live in shrinks. The amount of food resources available to keep them alive shrinks significantly. We talk mostly about the palm oil industry as being the primary threat, simply because it has grown at a massive rate over the last 30 or 40 years and replaced huge swathes of forest across Sumatra and Borneo. So that's really the greatest threat, simply because of the scale of the expansion of that industry has been so much greater than the impact even of illegal logging, which used to be cited as the main problem for species such as orangutans.
So the scale is just huge.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. On Sumatra now, there is over four times as much land covered in oil palm plantations as there is orangutan habitat left standing. Is quite a huge amount.
So what happens to those orangutans in that habitat as it's being encroached upon? Are they being killed? Are they all moving into one area to escape that kind of industrial development?
Yeah, it depends really. I mean, the orangutans will retreat into the forest as it's being cleared around them. So sometimes what happens is that very small fragments, patches of forest are left scattered in a landscape that's been cleared for oil palm plantations, and orangutans need really large areas to roam and find enough resources to survive. So if they're left in a small area of forest, they might be able to survive for a little while, but they won't be able to cross through the oil palm plantation to get back to a large area of forest to be able to breed and find enough food resources, so they would eventually die. Some are captured, either to be kept as pets by the people who capture them, or to be sold on into the illegal pet trade. Orangutans can earn quite a lot of money for the poor people that are involved in doing this forest clearance. So, yeah, there's quite a wide range of impacts. They can, as I say, retreat into bits of forest, get stranded in the middle of a landscape that's growing oil palms around them, or they're captured sometimes. I haven't seen this with my own eyes, but I've seen many photos and video footage and spoken directly to the rescue teams that have gone out to try and pick up orangutans from bits of forest that are in the process of being cleared. They can be quite brutally attacked by people as well, sometimes killed.
And they're being attacked because?
Many reasons. Sometimes people are afraid of them. They might not have seen an orangutan before. They don't know what they are. Orangutans can get aggressive if they're being threatened. sometimes. We've even heard tales that some oil palm companies have actually paid their employees to go and find orangutans and, you know, bring back the head as the bounty to prove that they've killed them because they want to remove orangutans from their land. This is linked to the fact that any area of forest that has an orangutan in it is classified as high conservation value, and high conservation value forests should not be converted to any other use. They should be left as they are. So removing orangutans from an area of forest that you as a company want to turn into a plantation solves that problem for you.
Hmm. Another one of the major ways, and you've touched on this already, is that the illegal pet trade, and I was really surprised and saddened to read about for every one orangutan that ends up as a pet, three have died, and that in order for the infants to become pets, you have to kill the mother. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely, yes. Well, the bond between a mother orangutan and her infant is incredibly strong. As I mentioned before, an infant will stay with a mother for anywhere between 5, usually up to 8 years, during that time learning how to be an orangutan, how to build nests, how to move through the forest, how to find which foods are good to eat. So the bond is very strong, and a mother orangutan would never just leave her infant behind in a situation where she was being threatened by a human. So it's necessary to kill the mother in order to get hold of the infant. The infant orangutans are very adorable looking. Everyone, you know, they're very cute and appealing, which is why they're highly prized as pets in some parts of the world. So generally the hunters, the poachers, aren't interested in capturing the mother. They're just trying to get to the baby, so the mother will be killed in order to capture the infant. Often, because orangutans are living in the forest canopy, if a mother is shot and the orangutan's infant is, you know, nearby or clinging onto her, he or she might fall out of the tree and be killed. Or they are sometimes they die of dehydration or shock or other causes in transit. If they're safely captured by a poacher, then they can then die in transit on the way to an animal market or to the home of someone who wants to buy the baby orangutan.
So the two major threats then could probably be categorized as habitat loss and then the illegal pet trade.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, and they're completely linked as well, because as forests are opened up for development, whether that's oil palm plantations or other agricultural development or even roads which are built through the forest, as the forest is opened up, then it makes it much easier for poachers to get in and access the orangutans and find them. All the pet trade.
One of the things that often comes up in this sort of really intensely complicated issue, where there's a lot of different stakeholders, lots of different populations that are being affected, animals, human communities are being affected, that often I feel, especially as animal rights folks and doing a show like this, I mean, we try to bring in different social justice issues as well, but inevitably people will often pin labor, human labor, against the animal issues. You know, you'd mentioned that the workers are poor, and that it's often seen as, well, who are you going to favor, the humans or the animals? And it's so striking with the research that's been done and the kind of collaborations that the Sumatran Orangutan Society has built, is that that is really a false dichotomy between human workers and animals with this issue. And there's all sorts of ways forward in terms of alternatives. So I was wondering if you could just weigh into some of the human consequences, some of the ways that in which communities are being affected, and then some of the ways that people are forging alternative, sustainable ways of still generating an income for their families without encroaching or hurting the orangutans.
Absolutely. Well, one thing to say about this is that the large oil palm companies that cause the massive scale of deforestation, there are smallholders planting oil palms as well, you know, a couple of hectares here and there, but it's when a plantation is several thousand hectares in size. That's where the problem lies, really. However, we're not calling for an end to oil palm plantations. The world does need palm oil as it stands at the moment, and that's not really set to change anytime soon. So what we say, really, is that there's an awful lot of land, literally millions of hectares of land in Indonesia across Sumatra and Borneo and other islands that is not forested. It's not useful land that's being used by anybody for anything at this time. It might have been previously burnt, or it might have been already cleared for logging or cleared for a plantation which was never planted. You'd be surprised how many companies apply for a license to clear an area of forest for a plantation. They then take the timber and sell that and then never bother to actually plant any oil palms or other crops. So there's actually millions of hectares available for these plantations. So what we say is it's not a case of destroying the palm oil industry and, you know, millions of people losing their livelihoods because of that. It's just a case of where these plantations are being put. They just should not be put in forested areas. People are certainly more than welcome to carry on making a living from selling palm oil and creating oil palm plantations. Just we ask that they don't put them in place of forests. The area where we're working in northern Sumatra is the Gunung Leuser National Park, which is really the last stronghold for the Sumatran orangutan. And one of the communities we're working with in an area called Besitang were really negatively affected by an oil palm company. It was quite a small to medium-sized company that came into the area. They actually went inside the national park, inside the protected area, and converted some of these protected forests into palm oil plantations. This was obviously completely illegal. So we've been working with the National Park Office, the government office, to remove those oil palms. And we're working with the local community to restore the forest. So we're replanting tree seedlings, rainforest indigenous tree species, and the community are making a living from that. We're also helping them develop agroforestry so that they can have alternatives that don't involve exploiting the forest. They were so badly affected by the presence of the palm oil plantation because it's a very water-intensive tree. It's a very thirsty tree, and it sucks up groundwater from miles around when you've got an oil palm plantation in an area. And this particular community, they were digging wells and they just weren't able to find water because of this plantation. So that really got them on board with the conservation agenda and wanting to restore the forest when they could see quite how much they actually depend on the services of the forest and the negative effects of removing forests from the land. So another area we've been working on in terms of other sustainable livelihoods is ecotourism, as well as a couple of communities we're working with in Bukit Luang and Tangkahan in northern Sumatra. We're training up local people to be forest guides. These are areas of forest where you can go there and see orangutans in their natural habitat, as well as many, many other species. So we're training up local people to become forest guides, to teach visitors about the forest and to follow certain rules, such as not being too close to the animals, not going into the forest if you have even a head cold, because the orangutans can get quite ill from human diseases, not to feed the animals, and various forest rules like that. So that's another fantastic source of income that results from not exploiting the forest by removing natural resources, but actually exploiting it by enjoying the natural resources staying as they are.
I liked how you said working with communities, because it really does seem that there's more partnerships that are being forged, and that seems really important. I think especially when you have people who are outside of Indonesia coming in and saying things like, you know, we need to train people to do different things, we need to rethink this form of agriculture, etc., that I think that people outside of the animal advocacy, you know, they might look at that and say, you know, you have really no right to go into these countries and to tell people how to live. But of course, as is so obvious with this issue, there's all sorts of the roots of this are in colonialism. There's all sorts of this international infiltration into Indonesia in terms of where the money's going, these companies, etc. So it seems much more complicated than just, you know, white people, for example, from the UK going in and saying, we need to train these people, they don't know how to treat their forests. It's yeah. really not, that's not the issue.
No, well, the way we get around that really is that all of our conservation work in Sumatra is carried out by Indonesian conservationists. It's so much more valuable for Indonesian people to be talking to other Indonesian people and telling them how things could be done differently if they wanted to get involved in supporting conservation. And our international branches around the world support the team in Indonesia by raising funds, raising awareness. Our campaigns support their work by calling on decision makers to make various important decisions, at a much higher level. So we're working internationally with governments, with the local government, and with the local communities. That really is grassroots as well as top down as well. But I think really that's a big key to our success, is that all the project work done in Sumatra is being carried out by Sumatrans themselves.
Yeah, I think that I was interested in what you had to say about the fact that you don't see the oil palm production dissipating necessarily or going away. That the world, I think you said the world needs palm oil, is going mm-hmm. to continue to need palm oil.
Yeah.
How do you see that, though, that particular industry being sustainable? Because even if we took out the questions around habitat loss, the workers are being, for the most part, it sounds, paid terribly. There's all sorts of corruption that's happening within that industry. Women's rights are being affected. I was reading, I think it's the Friends of the Earth PDF, really detailed report about all the different ways that human rights violations are happening as well. How do you see those issues being addressed within the oil palm industry itself?
Yeah, they've got a long way to go. Obviously, not just environmentally, but socially as well. You've listed several problems there. That land is stolen from communities. The workers are often not treated well. There are some companies doing things well and providing medical care and schools for the children of their employees. But it's, few and far between. I think one reason I said the world needs palm oil is because it's actually the most productive vegetable oil per hectare. So in a sense, the world needs vegetable oil. And in order to satisfy the world's demand for vegetable oil, palm oil is actually the most efficient way to do that compared to other alternatives such as rapeseed oil or soy oil. But when it comes to the human rights abuses and the social impacts of the industry, yeah, I absolutely agree. There's a really long way to go. There is an organisation called the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. We're a member of that. Many businesses are members of that. Many other social and environmental organisations are members. Basically, any oil palm company which is a member of this RSPO has made a commitment to improvement on all sorts of levels, including things such as deforestation, but also human rights and the care of their workers. So being a member of the RSPO does not necessarily mean that you have got a great track record, but it does mean that the company is making a commitment to try to improve things, and I think that has to be the first step, and it may not be happening quickly enough. Well, it certainly isn't happening quickly enough, but we just need to encourage companies to do things better and maybe to work with the Indonesian government to actually legislate for that as well. I mean, there is already, of course, human rights legislation. It's just a question of enforcing it and monitoring it.
And
unfortunately, it's fallen on NGOs such as Friends of the Earth and others such as the Rainforest Action Network to police the industry, really, and to check that companies are doing things the right way. It's a big job.
There's really so much to talk about. I knew this would happen, that we wouldn't be able to get to everything. I just wanted to touch or ask you to touch a little bit on climate change, because even if you're not concerned with orangutans, which hopefully you are in Sumatra, or the human rights abuses that are happening, displacement of people, women's rights issues, all sorts of corruptions, activists being attacked, people have been killed over this issue. There's all sorts of conflicts, violent conflicts that have happened. Even outside of those specific locales, with the burning of the forests and peat, this also has a huge impact on climate change. I was wondering if you could just talk about that for a few minutes.
Yeah, I mean, the forests that orangutans live on, in which millions of people within Indonesia depend for all sorts of ecosystem services and water and soil nutrients and just basic things like that, they really are important to the whole world when it comes to talking about the climate issue, because a lot of, as you mentioned, the peat forests are particularly valuable. There's an area in Sumatra called the Tripa Peat Swamp Forest. It's incredibly deep, Pete. Very valuable from the carbon point of view. Very valuable from the orangutan point of view. It's got the, well, used to have until it started being destroyed, the most dense population of orangutans, and culture was also seen for the first time in orangutans living in the Tripa area. It's important to the local people. It's a coastal area, so it's a tsunami buffer zone. If another natural disaster was to hit the area, then the forests there are being depleted, and that means that much more damage would happen inland. But it's valuable for the whole world because of the amount of carbon that's stored in the peat under these forests. And I think, you know, we often use the orangutan as a bit of an ambassador for its forests, because if you save the orangutan, you're saving countless other species that it shares its habitat with, and you're saving these carbon sinks, which are important to the whole world. Indonesia is now in the top three greatest carbon emitters alongside USA and China.
Wow.
And that is entirely linked to the rate of deforestation rather than industrial causes of carbon. Because the rate of deforestation is so high, then so much carbon is being released, which obviously affects every one of us.
Helen, I wish we had more time. I hope you'll come back on the program. We'd love to keep talking with you. I know that we've just skimmed the surface.
Many thanks. It's been great talking to you.
We have about a couple more minutes left. I want to turn it over to you. I definitely want to plug the website. It's orangutans-sos.org. It's, of course, linked on our website, animalvoices.ca. And I'll turn it over to Helen if you have any last words for our listeners.
Sure. I think, go and have a look at our website. Find out a bit more about orangutans, also what we do, all our tree replanting projects or our community-based work. There's many different ways people can get involved, so have a browse, click on the How to Help link and see which way would suit you to support what we do. We have a Facebook page and we're on Twitter as well, so if you want to be kept up to date with news from the field in Sumatra and conservation in general, then do follow us and keep up to date with everything that's going on.
Helen, thank you so much for your work.
Thanks very much indeed.
And I do hope you'll come back on the program again.
Absolutely.
Because I'd love to get more into the issues with you.
Yes, they're very complicated.
They are. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye for now.
Bye.
You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. We were just speaking with Helen Buckland. She's the UK director with the Sumatran Orangutan Society. This program will be archived within about a week on our website, animalvoices.ca. I want to thank again Charissa for coming in and teching for us and doing some magic there with the tech board. We had some issues and you were fabulous. Thank you, Steve, for producing this show, and I really do hope that we get to talk with her more. And please go check out the website. It's one of the most comprehensive, rigorous, well-researched websites on any animal issues that I've ever seen. Very impressed. And stay tuned for Charissa. She's going to be playing some tunes in the next couple of hours. And Steve, next week we have it set up. Who are we speaking with?
Next week we're going to be speaking with Rita, I cannot remember her last name, from Stop UBC, a campaign at the University of British Columbia to stop animal testing on their campus.
Great. It's going to be controversial, very interesting. It's really difficult to find good information, so I'm excited to talk about animal testing and animal testing in Canada and how people are trying to address that issue.
Yep.
So that's next week on Animal Voices. Stay tuned with Charissa. She's going to be playing some tunes. She always plays good stuff. So if you have any questions or comments, you can write us animalvoices@gmail.com. Again, check out our Facebook group. We'd love it if you joined. And thank you for listening. It's been an interesting show. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you tune in next week.